war against Palestinians. This is coupled with internal pressure by the families of hostages and the broader Israeli regime public on the government to actively pursue their release. In light of mounting domestic and international pressure, the Zionist regime's government has been working to craft a narrative to justify the extreme violence it continues to inflict on more than 2.3 million residents in the Gaza Strip in the name of fighting the threat of Hamas. Historically, there have been numerous instances of militaries punishing civilian populations and subjecting them to sadistic and degrading treatment after failing to attain their political or military objectives. In response to global calls to halt its deliberate targeting of civilian infrastructure, the Zionist regime's government continues to desperately establish the purported military presence of Palestinian armed factions within major hospitals across the Strip. This effort materialized in an intense aerial and artillery shelling campaign on hospitals, including Gaza's main medical complex of Ashifa. The attacks, targeting patients and displaced individuals within hospitals, extended to the detention, mistreatment, and exploitation of doctors as human shields. In a disturbing turn of events, the Zionist regime troops blocked medical staff from retrieving the bodies of victims from hospital courtyards, leaving them exposed to animals for an extended period. In other incidents, eyewitnesses testified to the Euromed Human Rights Monitor that the Zionist regime troops assaulted and humiliated Palestinian civilians using the designated safe corridor to evacuate Gaza City and the northern Gaza Strip, according to this group. One eyewitness account stated that an Israeli regime troop ordered a Palestinian man to strip while awaiting checkpoint approval. When another Palestinian questioned the troops' actions, he was fatally shot in the head with onlookers, including his family, barred from providing assistance or recovering his body. In a distressing series of events, accounts emerged of the Zionist regime troops subjecting displaced women to degrading treatment and humiliation in the designated safe corridor. Reportedly, two displaced women were ordered at gunpoint to undress in front of hundreds of onlookers before being permitted to redress and continue their journey southward. Additionally, in the northern Gaza Strip, a woman who was 5 months pregnant recounted an incident where an Israeli regime officer ordered her to take her clothes off and threatened her with rape if she did not comply. More recently, circulating video footage purportedly recorded by the Zionist regime military depicts numerous Palestinian men abducted and humiliated in the northern Gaza Strip. The men were predominantly displaced individuals seeking refuge in residential buildings and UNRWA-run schools amid the Zionist regime's bombardment. They were shown shirtless and stripped down to their underwear, with their hands raised behind their heads. The Zionist regime forces had lined them up on the street and taken photos and videos of them. The videos were shared widely by Zionist media outlets and troops, who have disseminated dozens of videos and pictures on their social media accounts, particularly since the ground invasion. In videos posted on TikTok and Instagram, they openly mock Palestinians as they celebrate the invasion of their neighborhoods and beaches. In other scenes of victory, they planted Israeli regime flags on vital facilities and headquarters, residential buildings and courthouses and universities. Contrary to the initial Israeli regime narrative locating the mass detention campaign in the Shajaiya neighborhood in the east of Gaza City and in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip, subsequent revelations disclose that the incident took place in Jabalia in the northern Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime's forces said those abducted were members of Palestinian armed factions. However, testimonies of eyewitnesses and members of the abductees' families collected by Euromed Human Rights Monitor's team on the ground and other organizations and journalists confirmed that they were unarmed civilians, including teachers at the UNRWA-run schools who are typically security checked multiple times before and during their work period with the United Nations, journalists and university students. The initial disinformation later corrected is not only a result of the Zionist regime's attempt to demonize Gaza residents, but is also indicative of a persistent endeavor to present an image of victory to its citizens and, most importantly, to its Western allies. It aims to provide supposed proof that its bloody military campaign, which has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians and displaced hundreds of thousands more, was in fact meant to subjugate all Palestinians into subordination and not simply eradicate the resistance movement Hamas. Violence within settler colonialism is a peculiar breed. This brand of violence goes beyond mere dominance or cultural erasure. It aspires to region over and obliterate not just communities, but the very essence of individual psyches. At its core, it seeks to humiliate. The Zionist regime employs a systematic strategy of humiliation to psychologically impact and break down Palestinian individuals and communities. The objective is to instill feelings of shame and degradation and potentially induce enduring psychological effects that erode Palestinian steadfastness and resistance. Despite being a consistently applied policy for the past seven decades, it has not succeeded in deterring the Palestinian population. An essential question for the Zionist regime is to reflect on the implications of internalizing and normalizing practices that involve humiliating fellow humans and taking pride in such actions. This systematic violation of human dignity and justice demands a critical examination of its impact on Israeli Zionist societal norms and values. The fabricated regime of Israel and its Western backers like to compare its genocide in Gaza to the Allied campaign in Dresden. But this is a false narrative. Unlike the Allies, who did not attempt to humiliate the people of Dresden, the Zionist regime's violence, particularly in its destructive power and evident desire to humiliate, is akin to the atrocities and humiliation witnessed during other parts of the world.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I'm Umay Biha Mukhtar, your host on IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. Joining us today is Sister Salma Khalfan, a respected Islamic researcher, and she will enlighten us on the concept of hijab as guided by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you very much for being here. Sister Salma, you have been speaking about what Ayatollah Khamenei has said about the principle of hijab between Islam and the West. And you had mentioned, you know, that he is calling women to morality, to modesty, to restrict relations between men, but not completely eradicate them or say that, no, it's not allowed. And you also said that we don't have to justify this hijab of ours. In fact, they should explain why this country, they are making people immodest. And you were saying that you're going to tell us more about the European custom and what they are saying about.
Yes, he says, Ayatollah Khamenei, that many other things that the Western culture should explain about what they are doing to the women, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for example, the European custom. In the modern world, people are sensitive to women's dress code. If, for example, a prominent figure, a philosopher, an army officer or a politician protests against lack of hijab, he or she will be jeered at, you know? People are not very sensitive to many issues of corruption and bad habits. If a country bans alcoholic drinks, it'll be jeered in the world. This country will be labeled as reactionary.
Yeah.
You know, where do these cultural norms belong? Where do the lack of hijab and legalization of alcohol drinks belong? These norms belong to Europe. They are rooted in the old cultural norms of European countries. They have this norm of not wearing hijab, you know, drinking alcohol. These norms are now assumed to be correct in other parts of the world as well. Unfortunately, they have, you know, exported these kind of norms. And if someone protests against them, he or she is thought to have committed a great sin. Contradicting obligations in the West, for example, France and Germany, two European countries that claim to care about human rights, so-called, did not allow a few women to wear Islamic hijab to school. In this particular case, they think compulsion is perfectly all right. This is a very good point here, Ayatollah Khamenei mentions about compulsion.
Yeah.
But all Western organizations protest against the Islamic Republic for making hijab compulsory. See, here they are facing compulsion not to put on hijab. And Islamic Republic says compulsion to put hijab. Both are compulsion. So Ayatollah Khamenei says, if it is wrong to impose a certain dress code on women, it would be more problematic than imposing hijab because hijab is more wholesome.
Yeah.
You know, these two issues, imposing hijab or lack of hijab, should be at least viewed as equal.
True.
You know? That if you can impose, even we can impose.
True.
Who are you to impose that no scarves?
Yeah, it's hypocritical.
It's the same thing. You should look at it with justice. We have even the right to impose.
Yeah.
It's our will, right? Our freedom. But the West does not like that. Why? Because it wants its norms to, you know,
continue.
In every part of the world, a global thing.
True. You know? And this is, I think, blind following in its best, because sometimes we feel like, why are they forcing this kind of freedom of, you know, drinking and all of these kind of things? Why is this forced on? They don't even realize the detrimental effects. They just feel like, oh, this is how it's supposed to be. This
and
is
they're
how.
Taking it so blindly that the word force doesn't come in them.
Yeah.
And the hijab force comes in them.
True.
If they could force these laws, then we can even force, if you want to put it as force, whilst it's not a force, it's something that is so logical. Every intellectual, sane person will accept it, right?
Yeah.
Women are actually humiliated in Western civilization. Regarding women's rights, we should not take a defensive position. Ayatollah Khamenei beautifully puts it, we should adopt an offensive position.
Yeah.
Not a defensive one. That, oh, the way you had mentioned in the last episode, that, oh, no, I do this hijab because of this. No, offensive. Why don't you do the hijab?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? What's wrong with your immorality?
Okay, so let's just take a quick break and we'll pick up shortly. Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady, and we have been talking about what Ayatollah Khamenei had to say about the European customs. And Sister Salma, you have been telling us how, you know, some things were imposed on the people and are looked at as, you know, that they are a must to do, or, you know, or they're so normalized that nobody questions them, like drinking, like that's a must, that's supposed to be allowed everywhere. And it's hypocrisy at its best, you know, that oh, they can do what they want to, but when we want to do what we want to, that's not allowed. And you also mentioned about how he has said you have to take an offensive approach, not a defensive, that we don't have to always go and say that, oh, I am, you know, I should do this because of this reason. No, why are they doing things that are not logical if you come to look at them?
Eminence then continues that they protest why our women should wear hijab and why hijab is obligatory. In the West, it is lack of hijab that is obligatory. Their problems with hijab are far more serious than this. Women have been degraded. Their problems are very serious. You know, he says women have been degraded in the Western world and Western culture. Women have been humiliated there. The fact that men and women are both allowed to achieve political positions cannot compensate for the problems Westerners have caused for women.
Yeah.
They've used women as an object of pleasure. That's the most problematic issue ever. They believe women are worthless without makeup, unfortunately. Even they give restrictions that when you want to come dressed attractively in short clothing, shorter than men's clothing.
True.
They believe women should wear makeup to make men admire them so that they can get their business. That much lower they have made women. And this is the greatest insult to women. We have our own strong arguments regarding the issue of women's rights. What they emphasize more than anything else is that Iran should conform to the global criteria.
Yeah.
You see? By criteria, they mean the things that are consistent with the norms of Western culture.
True.
And that makes them so selfish. Therefore, this kind of pressure is constantly used by Westerners. Whenever a non-Western culture, especially Islamic culture, which is not passive and submissive, is promoted somewhere in the world, they fight it vigorously, like France and Germany.
Yeah.
You know, discarding the scarf, headscarf. And they pressurize the people and they humiliate them because of that. They can force, but we can't force. If you want to use it even as force in the first place.
True.
So that is the downfall of the society when they do this kind of, you know, atrocities to women. And some women realize that and they fight for it, their rights back. Like we know that many people, you know, stood against their rights and are still doing that, but some people unfortunately fall in that pitfall and they subdue to whatever the government wants.
Yeah, and I feel like this is where we have to come and stand up and say that we want our right as well to be, you know, Muslim women, to be like free to do what we
choose. Imagine if that day would come when women say, we want our rights of hijab, right? It yeah. would be just heavenly. And I think, yeah, Ayatollah Khamenei wants that to happen also, that women realize their own worth, realize the gem inside them.
Yeah, I think it's just looked as something very oppressive that, you know, okay, even...
And Ayatollah all this Khamenei, is because of the media.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the world today, where have we seen there is equal rights or there is justice? I mean, look at how much tyranny the West has done, has committed. And yet they are there sitting and having luxurious lives after killing so many people in the world. So many countries are in the verge of collapse just because of the involvement of the Western powers. And they're there sitting luxuriously because they are kind of holding the reins. Why are we letting that happen? Why are we letting them hold the reins of this world? We want to hold the reins ourselves. We want, you know, the right and the justice of this world to, you know, flourish. We kind of look at them as supposed to be the ones who are supposed to give us this justice. Why? Why can't we look at other more pious people? Or why can't we look at Islam, the complete religion, you know, to come and show us this way? Why are we so, you know, blindsided by their ideologies. I feel like it's a pity, you know, when we don't look into this kind of problems and see the real reason behind them. So we're just going to pause briefly and we'll resume in a moment.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady, and we've been discussing about the principle of hijab between Islam and the West. And Sister Salma, you've been telling us about how it kind of leads to the downfall of society and how we have to kind of bring this aspect of hijab as something beautiful. And I wanted to ask another question. It seems like the Western world must be influenced with this Islamic dressing too. Has Ayatollah Khamenei mentioned anything regarding this?
A beautiful statement is given that the influence of hijab on the West is that Muslim women have developed a tendency towards hijab in different countries. You know, as far as when knowledge flourishes and, you know, when a person acquires knowledge with a broad mind and a clear heart, then they will, of course, come to realize that this is such a beautiful value in Islam, right?
True, true.
Especially as we mentioned that it is so close to the natural inclination of a woman. So in Islamic countries where hijab had previously been abandoned due to Western teachings, and even in European countries, of course, it was Muslims who first showed their tendencies towards hijab. And we saw after the revolution that women living in distant countries, which had been bezeled by Western and European culture, were trying our form of hijab amongst themselves. Ayatollah Khamenei says that they have embraced the form of hijab that is currently practiced in our country.
Yeah.
That means there are many who have embraced this, you know, and practiced this value. And today it is the Western world which is gradually developing a tendency towards hijab as well.
True.
Across the world, women are developing a tendency towards hijab. He knows what he's talking about, of course.
Yeah,
he must have researched and said, right, that what countries are really developing a tendency towards hijab. And there's so many countries, of course. We can even, you know, point out like Malaysia, Turkey. There's so many, you know, Iraq. Of course, these are the Middle East countries, but the Western countries also,
yeah,
for
there's
example.
So many people.
Canada, America. There's so many communities that observe hijab. And they are, you know, like strict about the rules of hijab.
And they're flourishing.
They have even community-based cities.
True.
Like, you know, in America, there's Orlando and these kind of small cities that have whole streets of Muslim women.
True.
So there's also Muslim kind of shops, Muslim vendors, Muslim meat sellers that sell halal meat. And this is just
Some side points.
But actually, across the world, women are developing this tendency.
In today's world, because we kind of see that, okay, why is the world becoming so immodest? And we kind of say, okay, should society determine modesty for us? If you look at society then and now, the idea of modesty is completely different. 100 years ago, you would see people, even in the West, who would look at skimpy clothing as something very bad and immodest. And, you know, and today, those are, you know, very normal. Like, it's okay to wear these kind of clothes.
Yeah.
So you see, you can never kind of look at society to tell you what modesty
is. Yeah, it's not a criteria.
Yeah.
They're just importing these kind of ideas, like the global, you know, criteria. That they want these kind of ideas to infiltrate even the Muslim countries. But if you go and see, even the Western countries were so respectable first.
Yeah.
A woman had even used to observe a veil, you know.
True.
But Ayatollah Khamenei says, after the Islamic Revolution, women, especially the intellectual women and female students, developed a tendency towards hijab. That means when, you know, respect was given to her and she was told to, you know, like, she can even expose her potentials by studying, becoming a scholar, taking part in the community, taking part in the social areas. Then, and this all happened after the revolution.
Yes, very true. I feel like when women, you know, take care of their hijab and their covering, it kind of makes so much more room to progress, because you're not so worried and kind of pressured about how you have to look all the time, you know, how you have to just, you know, be the way the people are outside. You have to kind of work yourself to meet those beauty standards outside in the world today. So thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening. You have just listened to Hijab by Sister Salma Khalfan, and we hope to see her in the next episode.
Inshallah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. We now present you a famous statement by Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, about the merits of his daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Fatima is a part of me. Whoever hurts her has hurt me. And whoever hurts me displeases God.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیبه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough.
تفرقوا فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله.
The war industry. Part 3.
After September 11th attacks, Blackwater changed its operation from providing training centers to work as a military contractor. By the support it received from officials, it signed big contracts amounting to billions of dollars.
Blackwater USA has been called the largest private army in the world.
My guest tonight is the controversial founder and former CEO of Blackwater, Eric Prince. Prince's firm made over $1 billion out of the so-called War on Terror. It also highlighted the clear danger of using private contractors on the battlefield. And yet now he's back on the scene, trying to privatize the war in Afghanistan by offering to replace US and NATO troops there with his own private security force.
Blackwater founders had established their company with the support of the State Department and the CIA. Following the 9/11 attacks and the occupation of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq, their main responsibility was to provide US diplomats and officials with security in those countries.
Without Blackwater to protect them, U.S. officials can't leave headquarters in the Green Zone.
We need protection for our diplomats.
On February 16th, 2005, an Iraqi vehicle came under heavy fire by Blackwater forces when they were escorting a U.S. military cavalcade. Later on, they claimed that the Iraqi vehicle targeted them, but an investigation revealed that one of the Blackwater agents had opened fire. On February 6, 2006, a sniper employed by Blackwater opened fire from the roof of the Iraqi Justice Ministry, killing three guards working for the Iraqi media network.
When you look at how private security contractors were operating in Iraq, it wasn't that surprising that something like Nusra Square was going to happen.
The last controversial move by Blackwater in Iraq was the deadly shooting incident in Al Nusra Square in Baghdad, which claimed the lives of several Iraqi civilians, including children.
17 Iraqis lie dead. Many more are wounded. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki tells Washington he wants Blackwater out of his country, a demand that soon reveals just how dependent the U.S. is on private contractors.
The Blackwater forces were acquitted in the first two incidents, and the U.S. officials even rejected punishing the security firm's forces involved in the killing of Iraqi guards, arguing such a move would lead to disappointment of Blackwater forces. But the last incident took them to court.
That Blackwater personnel have shot and killed innocent civilians, don't you?
I disagree with that.
What happens in Nusra Square points up the chief source of controversy over the use of contractors. Who do they report to? Where do they fit in the chain of command? Or are they outside it altogether?
In August 2007, Jean Richter, who was sent on a mission to Iraq to check Blackwater's activities, in an article warned that the security firm had been overlooked and they consider themselves above the law.
The Army had a much more highly defined hierarchy, a more regimented command structure, and then you had these private companies who could do whatever they want. And they did.
In fact, this was one of the original reasons for using private contractors. The administration didn't have to ask Congress for permission.
The probe on Blackwater was halted, but after all those developments, Blackwater was forced to change its name to Exis Services to erase its activities in Iraq and Afghanistan from memories. After years, their history had new dimensions.
You mentioned there that the U.S. government asked you to do a job and you did it. You mentioned that you lost men on your watch. What you didn't mention is that you also killed a lot of people. You say, well, you know, percentages is great. Let's talk about individual cases. In 2005, Blackwater Guards fired 70 rounds into an Iraqi civilian's car, forcing the State Department to investigate. In 2006, according to leaked Pentagon documents, Blackwater Guards fired indiscriminately at Iraqi civilians, killing, among others, an ambulance driver. In 2007, Blackwater Guards shot and killed 14 Iraqi civilians in what's been called the Nisour Square Massacre, or Baghdad's Bloody Sunday. That is the record that a lot of people around the world remember when they hear the name Blackwater.
Sure, and when you do 100,000 missions, it's easy to take some things out of context. But remember, you had many thousands of insurgents actively trying to kill Americans, and not just American servicemen, but the most newsworthy Americans there, diplomats. And when the State Department asked you
but
to
drive... But the
people
I'm mentioning weren't insurgents. You killed, Nisour Square, your men killed a mother and son on their way to an appointment, a doctor and
sadly,
her son. They killed a nine-year-old boy, shot him in the head.
Sadly, the insurgents don't wear uniforms. They would drive ambulances filled with explosives. They would drive...
So your men thought they were shooting at insurgents?
A car bomb doesn't give you much time to decide.
There was no car bomb at Nisour Square in 2007.
Blackwater was now more than a private army. The most important thing that gave the company power, and no one could question it, was its services to the U.S. government. Whenever the U.S. Army decides to make a move without having blood on its hands, it asks Blackwater to do its dirty work. Supporting Blackwater, or Exis Services, or as it is today called Academy, wasn't limited to the Obama or Bush administrations. Two of Trump's aides, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, made efforts to outsource the long war in Afghanistan to private security firms like Blackwater. The goal was clear: reducing the costs and warding off the risks posed against the American soldiers. Supporting the private military firms in order to not taint their hands with blood was the lucky but short-lived star of the Ephraim and his friend David. Signing a contract with two inexperienced young men by the Pentagon was very strange. David said during the meeting with the Pentagon officials, they were so confident that the officials didn't even ask about the background of two young men in their 20s. But the fact is, if the Pentagon wanted to check their background, it could easily do that, especially since they weren't in a good status on the list of suspicious people prepared by the State Department. They had a record of smuggling in illegal weapons. Pentagon even overlooked their failure in the previous projects. The overlook was in fact a tool for the Pentagon to push forward its goals. So, by outsourcing the project to a small firm, they could put a cover on the crisis in the future. The Chinese bullets David and Ephraim gave the Pentagon in Russian packaging were discovered after a while. They were tried and were given a 7-month house arrest for bypassing federal laws. They weren't so lucky to stay in the military business for years, just like Eric Prince and Blackwater did in Afghanistan and other places. Or maybe their problem was they couldn't find the right conduits in the Pentagon. So their ambition blew up in their faces and retired in a position of massacring people while they were still in their 20s. They could probably earn huge amounts of money in this industry for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear friend. Inshallah, you are doing well. So welcome. This is another episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. I invite you to listen to us. First, we'll look at the calendar. Then we're going to speak about promoting humanity. So please be with us.
I pray to God, my heart, soul, and body, every single day of my life, with every breath, I solemnly promise to try to live my life for you. Oh, Allah, you did revive my soul and shone your light into my heart. So pleasing you is now my only goal. Oh, I love you so. I love you so.
Today, Thursday, 14th of Jamadil Thani, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 7th of Day, 1402 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 28th of December, 2023 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We open Allah's book, the Holy Quran, and we'll listen to chapter Az-Zumar, verse 73. Then we'll speak about it.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. وسيق الذين اتقوا ربهم إلى الجنة زمرا حتى إذا جاءوها وفتحت أبوابها وقال لهم خزنتها سلام عليكم طبتم فادخلوها خالدين.
But those who feared their Lord will be driven to paradise in groups until when they reach it, while its gates have been opened and its keepers say, "Peace be upon you, you have become pure. So enter it to abide eternally therein." They will enter.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Purity is the prerequisite to being admitted to paradise, which has come into being owing to either someone's primordial natural disposition or repentance. According to a narration narrated from Imam Ali, peace be upon him, paradise has 8 gates, each of which is for a certain group. One for prophets and sincerely devout believers, one for martyrs and good doers, 5 for my adherent or Shias, and 1 for Muslims who bear no grudge against me.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you.
Our topic is about promoting humanity. The concept of human in Islam is seen in a treaty that the Prophet partook before his prophethood, which is translated to the League of the Virtues, written up
After the mistreatment of a Yemeni merchant, the treaty promised to uphold justice for all who were oppressed in Mecca, regardless of their status and background. During his prophethood, the prophet still acknowledged the validity and value of the treaty, saying, "It was more beloved to me than a herd of red camels, and if I were called to it now in the time of Islam, I would respond." It is through this treaty that we see Islam following a set of principles and morals that are grounded in practicality and also protecting the rights and dignity of people.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. How can we be a better human? What does Islam or other religions say about achieving success to be a better person, a better personality, or to be a human? The next factor that we need to look at is remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Relationship with Allah and love of Him not only result in peace, tranquility, and calmness of the heart and mind, but they are also considered to be among the effective causes of spiritual growth, as well as perfection of other personality aspects. Worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and communion with the Lord lead to piety and continence, and piety leads to man's prosperity and salvation. The next factor, or let's say the seventh factor that we want to look at and talk about, is sincerity that makes us a better human. Sincerity is a rare elixir which affects man's action. Sincerity has been defined as showing yourself as you really are and being inwardly what you show yourself to be. It also means to be free from ostentation and polytheistic conducts. One of the impacts of sincerity is success in life. Imam Ali al-Islam says, in this regard, success is the undertaking referred to making your intentions more sincere. The eighth factor is making recourse to Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. The household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasalam are like stars shining and leading mankind to the right path. They are the best role models. Following them and adhering to their teachings will lead to success.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today's special.
Today's special speak about moral behavior. Islamic tradition holds that moral qualities and good actions elevate the status of a man. The Quran and the Hadith serve as the primary source of moral and ethical guidance in Islamic theology. Both the Quran and the Hadith often speak in emphatic manners to instruct the Muslims to adopt a morally good character. In particular, respecting parents and elders, having love for younger, greeting people in correct manner, showing kindness to fellow people, caring for the sick, asking permission before entering into others' house, speaking the truth, and avoiding rude and false speech have been emphasized. The typical Islamic teaching is that imposing a penalty on an offender in proportion to their offense is permissible and just, but forgiving the offender is better. To go one step further by offering a favor to the offender is regarded the highest excellence. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny said, "The best among you are those who have the best manners and character." To the Muslims, the examples of moral virtues set by Prophet Muhammad and his Ahlul Bayt serve as guidance both practically and theologically. One way or tip for becoming more human is when thinking H2H, remember H2H equals H plus H, humor and humility. Take 5 seconds and think about the three friends you love being around the most. I bet boredom, arrogance are not words you associate with them. Levity brings the mood up and humility opens up space for forgiveness and acceptance. If you can establish an atmosphere of humor and humility, you will go a long way toward growing your audience, moving them to action and giving you grace if an issue does arise.
I would like to talk about the worth of a human being from the Islamic point of view. And as a preamble to that, let me talk about, you know, the position of human being in the world. And this is where we look at the social dimension of Islam and the Ummah. You know, this is where people have to actually get together. They use their talent, their knowledge, their expertise, and their, you know, ability to do hard work and help one another. This is where ta'awun comes in. This is where they really, you know, help one another. In most of the cases, when we talk about this interdependency of human beings in a society, this is done on a give and take basis. You know, so you have a doctor, uses his talent, his expertise and knowledge to treat himself and his children, but not only that, he will also treat other people who are not doctors. But when he does it for them, he will charge a fee. On the other hand, for example, you will have somebody who is a teacher, has the ability to teach. Not all parents can be good teachers. Actually, even good teachers cannot be good teachers for their own children. You know, so then you need help of somebody else. Now, other person will use his expertise, his knowledge to teach your children. In return, he will say, I want the fees. This is how the community basically, you know, the society moves further, that we use our ability and our talent and our time to help one another, and collectively we are able to bring everyone to a higher level. Salawat upon the Ikbarah. And so that, you know, give and take is very normal. But then there are some people in the society, in all communities, who use their expertise, who use their knowledge, their ability to work hard. They use their time in order to serve the community without asking for anything back. And this is what is known as volunteerism.
That was all for today's special, and of course, to promote humanity. Inshallah, we continue this topic. So follow us on parstoday.ir/en. Thank you very much, and fi amanillah.
Told me that I'm crazy, who you're praying for? They told me there is nothing, who you're looking for? Stop doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies. My eyes were locked, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside, I know that there's a better world.
Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English.